From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. So, Norm Ornstein, if you could pick one word to describe the state of American politics today, Norm, what would that word be?
Abysmal.
One word to describe the Democratic Party?
Angry.
One word to describe the GOP?
Cult.
Abysmal, angry, and cult. Norm, there's not one positive word in that group. Is it really that bad?
Well, it's sunny out here today. Other than that, there's not much that you can say that's positive in the state of American politics right now. We have an election coming up where we're concerned across the board about disruptions, about questions of legitimacy. We have a president who just the other day said that he needs that ninth Supreme Court justice because the election might be a hoax and they might need to resolve it. That's not a good state of affairs. The way in which the Senate, Mitch McConnell, but also at least 50 of his colleagues have said that they're going to vote to confirm a justice to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg without even knowing who's been nominated. They've made commitments to do so. And blowing up what remains of the shattered and tattered norms of the Senate, not a particularly good thing. The pandemic, the divisiveness in the country, the inability to reach an agreement on a recovery package while people are being evicted and are in hospitals and dying. The story that we just saw last night, reported by Rachel Maddow, that the Centers for Disease Control worked with the Department of Agriculture to water down the warnings and guidelines for meat processing plants that resulted in hundreds of additional deaths. I'm searching, Meghna, for something positive to say right now, and my search so far is futile.
You have come loaded for bear today, Norm. I will say that for sure. So for folks who don't recall, Norm Ornstein is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. And we're going to talk about the role of such institutes later in this abysmal state of politics, Norm. He has studied American politics, elections, Congress, worked in Congress. He's been an astute observer of American politics for 50 years and is also a contributing writer for The Atlantic and a columnist for The National Journal, author of One Nation After Trump. That was from 2017. And also, It's Even Worse Than It Looks from 2012. So, Norm, has it been it being the dysfunction in your 50 years of observing American politics and being involved, has it been as bad as the case that you're laying out now?
I really don't think so. I've lived through some really tumultuous periods in American life. I remember vividly, as so many people in my generation do, exactly where I was when John F. Kennedy was assassinated, when Robert Kennedy was assassinated, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, the period surrounding the Vietnam War, the violence, the demonstrations, the fear, in fact, that we might end up with some kind of a police state, the questions that were raised when Richard Nixon was impeached about whether he would leave. All of those things created plenty of tumult, the entire civil rights era. But in our lifetimes, we haven't seen anything like this. And it's been clear to me, my co-author Tom Mann and I, when we wrote the book in 2006, The Broken Branch, that we were seeing the norms and the processes of government begin to deteriorate. At that point, both parties clearly to blame in some measure. By 2012, when we did It's Even Worse Than It Looks, it became clear to us that this was becoming asymmetric and that we had one party that was going off the rails, the Republican Party. The seeds were set well in advance for a Donald Trump to emerge. But what Trump has been is really an accelerant in a, I hate to use the analogy of a forest fire right now, another element of life that's not making us very happy, along with Newt Gingrich and Mitch McConnell, in blowing up the fundamental norms of governance. And one of the things that's been so striking to me, Meghna, is We can have a constitution in place. We can have laws in place. We can have rules in place. But what's required to make it work, the cartilage and the ligaments that keep everything together, is the norms in the system. Mm-hmm. And when those go, and it's not just those inside, it's outside, it's a tribal media that's emerged. When you move towards a kind of tribal political division, we've seen this in other societies and they've fallen apart. It's almost impossible to come up with any kind of consensus around where we go and what you're supposed to do. And we're at a crossroads right now, and finding a way back is not going to be easy, and it isn't going to happen quickly.
Mm. Well, Norm, hang on here for just a second, because I want to bring in Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst, with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Magda. Hello, Norm.
So,
hi, Jack.
What do you make of Norm's prescription here about the abysmal state of U.S. politics?
Well, I think that's a well-considered word. And here's an example of the abysmal state of politics. This is from an article just being published in the Atlantic Monthly by Barton Gellman from sources. Trump plans to bypass election results and appoint loyal electors in battleground states where Republicans hold the legislative majority. With justifications based on claims of rampant fraud, Trump would pressure state legislatures to set aside the popular vote and exercise their power to choose a slate of electors directly. That's the end of American democracy within 40 days, it seems to me.
But so this is speculation, though, Jack. I mean, how does, when someone out there hears that and says, well, how is that not Trump derangement syndrome, as they like to call it? I mean, what's your response to that?
Well, I haven't read the whole article. Barton Gellman is a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter. He's just been hired by The Atlantic. He's known for his impeccable sources, and he speaks here of sources within the Republican Party have told him that this is one of the plans that the Trump people are contemplating and perhaps even working toward. So if it be derangement syndrome, then count me deranged.
Mm. Norm, what do you think?
So you ask, how do we know anything about this beyond what Bart has found? And I talked to Bart during the course of his research also. But it's hiding in plain sight. We had Donald Trump Jr. Just yesterday basically say, these votes that are going to be cast by mail, they're corrupt. Millions and millions of them are corrupt. We had the comment that President Trump made that I mentioned earlier on. We've had the president say over and over again that these votes cast by mail are not to be counted. We know that on election eve in many battleground states like Wisconsin, we're going to have results that are skewed towards the president because more Republicans by far are planning to vote in person, and more Democrats and independents are planning to vote by mail. We could well get the president declaring victory on election eve when barely a third of the votes have been counted in key places. I don't think this is a certainty, and I'm on two task forces, one in particular run through a group called Protect Democracy, a broad-based task force that includes people like the former Homeland Security Secretary under President Bush, Michael Chertoff, working on potential crises and trying to head off any of the bad things that can happen. It should be noted here, Magda, that this nightmare scenario really is probably only going to work if the Democrats lose the Senate, don't take over a majority of the Senate. Because under the Electoral Count Act, which goes back to 1887, the House and Senate convene on January 6th. That's the new Senate and House, and decide what happens with electors, which ones are going to be counted. If there are contested electors, they both have to agree. If they don't agree, then we get into a completely different territory. I would say, in addition, that we obviously have another fear. something that's been raised by Attorney General Bill Barr, and that is, and by President Trump, and that is that we're going to get paramilitary forces and outsiders, thugs, going out, intimidating voters, maybe creating violence at the polls, and throwing everything into disarray. And the president has himself threatened that he might invoke the Insurrection Act and nationalize the National Guard and move in a bad way. Now, none of these things reach a level of probability of 50% or more, but they're not zero. And we all have to be vigilant. And it's very clear that the Senate races matter, that getting people to vote, and especially for those who can vote at the polls even early, who are willing to do so, would be helpful. And it would be helpful if we had an election that was not close in any fashion. We're in a different territory than we've been in our lifetimes.
So when you said the probability is not zero, that's the thing that I will want to focus on for just a second. We have to take a break here in a minute, Norm. But because I think listening to this, on the one hand, one wants to feel some confidence in the core very structures of American democracy that we have relied on for the past couple of centuries. We did have a civil war. But on the other hand, the very existence of a non-zero probability of some kind of a devastating abuse of power in November, how do you balance those two and move forward as a country?
Oh, if you want me to answer before the break,
okay.
It'll take kind of a long answer.
I won't cut you off because you're right. We have 37 seconds, in fact, before the break.
Let me just say quickly, we need to hope that all of the forces of civil society, our former presidents, our former military leaders, our university leaders, our religious leaders and others will recognize this and step to the fore and keep anything from getting out of control. We're in a tribal environment, and this is a dangerous time, and we all need to acknowledge and recognize it.
Norm Ornstein, Jack Beatty, stand by. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Norm Ornstein. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies politics, elections, and Congress. For 50 years, he has been a political scientist and close observer of U.S. politics, co-author of several books, including One Nation After Trump, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, and The Broken Branch. Jack Beatty is also with us. He's On Point's news analyst. Now, Norm, you basically gave us sort of a pretty good framework for marching through this hour when you said that your one word for American politics right now was abysmal, your one word to describe Democrats angry, and your one word to describe the GOP today is cult. So let's take on that third one right now. Cult? Really? How would you measure the cultishness of the GOP?
So when I've looked at the reaction that Republicans in Congress have had to President Trump, including all of those from Lindsey Graham on down through Kevin McCarthy back when he was running for president, believing that he was a demagogue, that he was a racist, that he was a xenophobe, that he was unfit for office. And now there isn't a single thing that he has said or done that has brought any criticism whatsoever. There is not a member of his administration up for confirmation in the Senate, including those who openly lied to the Senate during the process, like Scott Pruitt, rejected. We've had almost no oversight in this process. what we see is in a whole host of votes as well, that people who you would expect to vote in a fashion that would benefit their constituents, look at all of the actions taken surrounding the pandemic, or that fit their own professed beliefs, instead going with Trump. And I say cult because what happens in a cult is the fear of being shunned, of being excommunicated, overwhelms almost everything else. And I look at a support for Trump among self-professed Republicans that is in the high 80s or low 90s. It doesn't matter what he says or what he does. That appears unshaken, with some notable exceptions, some suburban women and men, college-educated men and women, some older voters now who are being hit by the pandemic. But in general, it's a level of support that is not typical for a political party. And with a president who has taken a series of actions that are destructive, including of their own interests, it's the only word that makes sense to me. When I see a Lamar Alexander, now here's a man in his 80s with a long and distinguished career, a former governor of Tennessee, a presidential candidate, a cabinet member, a very good secretary of education, comes to the Senate, becomes one of those figures who is really carrying the torch for the institutional integrity of the Senate, chair of the HELP Committee, Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, does no oversight of the corruption in the education department over student loans, over private schools, does no oversight of the abuses in the Department of Health and Human Services with child separation and the handling of asylum seekers, and then goes along with a vote on a Supreme Court justice going completely against the pledge that he and others had made. He's retiring. Hmm. It's not like he's going to become a lobbyist and he's worried about what kind of clients he's going to get. This is, I'm in on the cult, and if I go the other way, when I go back to Tennessee, my friends and the people I am connected with are going to treat me badly, shun me. There's no other explanation for it that I can come up with.
So I wonder if, I'm trying to think through this, Norm, okay, that a lot of people hearing this and hearing you use that word cult, it kind of gets their hackles up to at the beginning, because you're talking about the grand old party, right? You're talking about one half of this country's longstanding two-party tradition that saw this country through major ups and major downs. And to say that this party, which represents the will of tens of millions of voters who voted in 2016, that, you know, are you writing off half the country as cultish, or specifically members of the GOP in Washington?
It's members of the GOP in Washington. It's a whole lot of people out in the country. And I would say, Meghna, I'm not alone in this. If you look at all of those conservatives and lifelong Republicans who are a part of the Lincoln Project now, from Bill Kristol to Steve Schmidt. When you look at some former members of Congress, people I've talked to, like Charlie Dent of Pennsylvania, once they leave, they're appalled by what they've seen. But I want to emphasize one thing, and that is, and this happened when Tom Mann and I took a flood of criticism when we did the book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks. Mm-hmm. And the day it was published, the Washington Post Outlook section had an excerpt from it, which our editor, Carlos Lozada, helpfully titled, "Let's Just Say It, the Republicans Are the Problem." And we got hit with criticism. And I'd worked very closely with a large number of Republicans in Congress over many years. And they were saying, "You're just trying to destroy us. You're trying to discredit our party." And my reaction was, "I'm trying to save you." The fact is, we cannot operate as a full-fledged constitutional democracy without two parties that are effectively focused on solving problems and not just on maintaining loyalty to continue to grasp power. And we used to have that with the Republican Party. And when we get it back, it's not going to be a centrist party. It's not going to be probably even a center-right party. It's going to be a very conservative party. But it will be a problem-solving party, and that's simply not there now. Mm. And, you know, just to pick one other example, the idea that in the midst of this horrific pandemic, with an economy that is in very bad shape, with people facing evictions, foreclosures, losing jobs, not having health care, that the Senate Republicans under Mitch McConnell would sit from basically June, maybe earlier, without even coming up with an alternative for a recovery package, waiting until now and then deciding that it's not even important to do it now. That's not a problem-solving party. A party that knows that the response to the pandemic has been a pathetic one, that we are ignoring or attacking science and does nothing about it. That is not a normal problem-solving political party. We need to get it back, but it is not anywhere close to that now.
Jack, jump in here with your thoughts about Norm's obviously searing indictment of the GOP.
Well, it applies to the GOP base as well. Look at the president's rallies now. Look at the people not wearing face masks. Look at them listening to him. This, as someone has called him, vector in chief. Say, oh, make fun of face masks. Look at the appalling record on truthfulness. According to the Washington Post, we're above 20,000 now, quote, false and misleading claims made by the president. You know, Mary McCarthy once said of Lillian Hellman that everything she wrote was false, including the ands and the buts. Well, Trump gets his ands and buts correct, but otherwise not much else. People settle for this. It doesn't matter to them, apparently, that he's lied to them as well 20,000 times. And that is cult-like behavior. It's as if they've suspended their rational faculties, people who earn a living, who get along, in this sort of trance that Trump has them in. And all of that is all rationality is out the window when it doesn't matter that you're telling me falsehoods. I don't care.
So, okay, so let's dig into this a little bit more, because it's definitely one thing the struggles of live radio. It is one thing to rightly go after the naked cynicism of power politics amongst the elite in the GOP. Totally. But when we also say that there's cultish behavior amongst tens of millions of average Americans who are casting their ballots, I would say in good faith, that challenges me a little bit. So let me just play a couple of pieces of tape, because Jack, as you know, we've spent many weeks over the past month, and we'll continue to do so, talking to actual voters, okay, about what they think and what they want and why they're casting their ballots for whichever candidate they are. So first of all, I'm going to play you a moment from a conversation we had with one of those voters, Cheryl Johnson from Cushing, Iowa. She talked to us back in August when we had a roundtable of people who had voted for Donald Trump in 2016, and here's what she told us.
I still believe that Donald Trump as a businessman represents what our country was founded on, capitalism, and as a businessman, and he might be crude and rude sometimes, but I do believe that he genuinely has the best of the American dream at heart for everybody in America.
So, Norm, I want to turn that to you, because is this just people being like sheep, or does Cheryl, who's a farmer and works day in and day out trying to keep her farm going, does she not? I mean, we shouldn't be writing off what she sees in Donald Trump. I mean, how does that connect with this cultish behavior you're talking about?
So we can unpack this a little bit, but in terms of how it connects with the cultish behavior, and it would be interesting to see what she would say now. Look at Bob Woodward's book, Rage, and not the book, but the tapes. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump himself talking. Donald Trump says back in February This is a deadly virus that's carried through the air. And now this week, yesterday, does an enormous rally with thousands of people packed in closely together without masks. To say that he's acting in the best interests of the American people, we have pretty clear and convincing evidence, the smoking guns all over the place, that that's not the case. Now, we know there's a lot of research, a lot of academic research that's been done and others that show that race is, as it has been since the founding of the Republic and before, a hugely important factor. And it's an important factor in support for Trump. But that's not everybody. It's not that everybody who supports him is driven by race. Some of it is the kind of myth that if only we had a businessman running the country, it would operate the way a business does. They didn't, I think, have in mind Trump University. But what we also know is we're in a tribal world right now. This is not just ideological polarization. Tribalism means that you look at people on the other side of the party divide as evil and the enemy, and they're trying to destroy our way of life. And support that we see from a lot of the people who are behind Trump is in part because if they criticize him or go against him, that's giving aid and comfort to the enemy. Hmm. And I think that's behind a lot of the wishful thinking, the framing of Trump as an empathetic man who's acting in our best interests, as a competent businessman who's running an efficient government. And what evidence shows that is exactly the opposite of that is discarded or pushed to the side. And we can't ignore here the role of tribal media.
Yeah.
And people who are getting most of their information and news from Fox and from talk radio, which views the pandemic as nothing serious and ridicules the idea of wearing masks. And lots of people who find that that's their main source frame it in a way that's different from what scientists do or others would say. It's a very troubling because much of this is now it's focused around Trump and his powerful personality, the dear leader. But a lot of these phenomena are going to be there after he's gone, and we're going to have to grapple with that and with the divisions that are pushed by outside forces that can make a lot of money doing so.
So about that media malpractice, as you've called it, Norm, we're going to talk about that more later. But I want to just focus for another couple of minutes on the Senate itself, because you have over the summer you wrote about what it used to be like. And the reason why I would love you to share a little bit of that with us is because, I mean, there are now, I would say, two generations of Americans who have never known anything other than the current political environment that we have. And to even imagine a more collegial, norm-following, collaborative, deliberative body like the Senate is just it's just outside the realm of possibility. So what was it like?
So I came to Washington in 1969. I worked in the Senate as a congressional fellow. I came back. I wrote a book about it in the 70s when I was a young scholar. I came back to work on and then become staff director of a committee that reorganized its committee system in 1976 and 77. I've been immersed in it ever since. I know a large number of the members well. Some of them I count as among my close friends. And of course, as a political scientist, I taught about Congress for many, many years. And when you teach about the Senate compared to the House, it was the Senate is a different body. They don't have these firmly structured rules and everything that they do in the House. Anytime a bill comes to the floor, it has a rule that tells you exactly how many amendments you can have, how much time will be spent, who can speak. And in the Senate, almost everything is done by unanimous consent. And they try and have to work together. They know each other better because there are only 100 of them. They've relied on their own goodwill. And the filibuster rule, Rule 22, which requires a supermajority if people are intensely engaged in an issue of great national significance, actually for a long time worked to bring the Senate together, because it was important, if you were doing something of significance, to get both parties on board, to have a kind of bipartisan leadership consensus. That's disappeared now. And that's been in the works for a long time. It's now a tribal and partisan entity. People distrust each other. The one thing that really worked in the Senate was your word is your bond from the individuals to one another. Look at all of those who have completely done a 180 when it comes to a Supreme Court justice. How are you going to trust them again? This is a different body, and it's not the way I think the framers expected a Senate to operate, even though it was a very different conception of the Senate back in the 18th century.
Hang on there, Norm. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next week on Wednesday, as we continue our voter roundtable series, which we've been doing on every Wednesday, we're going to be talking to suburban voters, put quotes around the word suburb. But both campaigns are focusing a lot on suburban voters. And if you think that's you, I want to know sort of what you think about the fact that both the Biden campaign and the Trump campaign think that it's those suburban votes that might carry the election. So call us with your story about what your hopes are for your communities at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. And let us know where you're from and why you think where you live qualifies as the suburbs. Again, that's for next week's show on our voter roundtable. Right now, we are talking with Norm Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, co-author of One Nation After Trump, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, and The Broken Branch, three of Norm's many books. Jack Beatty also joins us. He's On Point's news analyst. And we're going through Norm's really diagnosis of the health of American democracy right now. He started off by describing to us how the state of American politics, in his word, is abysmal. Then we spent the last segment talking about why Norm thinks that the GOP now qualifies as a cult. And the third word you used, Norm, at the beginning was that when I asked you to describe the Democrats, you said angry. So I've never been one to think that just abject anger helps solve any problems. But what do you think? Is an angry Democratic Party going to be part of whatever the solution is that this country needs to make its democracy healthier?
Well, one question at this point is whether the anger translates into a surge in votes at the polls that could alter outcomes, create possibly a wave that would give a significant Democratic majority in the Senate, as well as the presidency and the House. But after that, it's a really open question as to whether the anger translates into an action plan. And there's a huge dilemma here, I would say, Meghna, and maybe multiple dilemmas. One is that Democrats are more a coalition of different groups. The Republican Party for a long time was a party focused more around ideology. Now I would say it's more around a kind of theology. But when you're a coalition of groups, getting everybody to agree on the same move forward is extremely difficult. They can do it occasionally on policy. We certainly saw it with the remarkable way in which early in the Obama administration, Democrats were able to even get all 60 in the Senate at that point to vote together to get the Affordable Care Act. But it's a rare kind of thing. And that's true on strategic and tactical concerns as well. But the other part of that dilemma is cleaning up the mess, if there is a Democratic Party in charge, from the Trump administration and the Republican Congress. We've seen a level of corruption here that is staggering, from cabinet members an attorney general who has operated in unprecedented ways, makes the Nixon administration look like a group of Mother Teresa's in comparison, a commerce secretary who has distorted the census and done insider trading. We could go on and on. The mismanagement of the pandemic I had mentioned earlier, intervention that killed large numbers of people in meatpacking plants involving the CDC and the Department of Agriculture. What are you going to do about all of the miscreants who have been there? And if you basically go after them, that's going to create probably a deeper division. And it looks like what happens in a dictatorship where you punish your enemies after you've won an election. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do substantively? And just as significant, what can you do to right the wrongs, including the packing of the courts that we've seen, starting with Mitch McConnell blocking legitimate court nominees for district courts, the courts of appeals, and the Supreme Court when Obama was president, and stacking the deck now? Do you violate further norms to go ahead and basically right those wrongs? There are no easy answers, yeah. But I don't see a party that is at this point unified in any more than by its anger. The other day, Dianne Feinstein, who is the senior Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, said, "I don't think we should do anything about the filibuster." The fact is, if you don't do anything about the filibuster, and what the Republicans under McConnell did throughout the Obama administration was to use the filibuster as a weapon of mass obstruction, voting against every nominee, every piece of policy to try to block it or delegitimize it. That same thing will happen again, and you will be frustrated and unable to come together and enact policies that are necessary. You will find your own base disillusioned and probably suffer a big defeat in 2022. Having that way forward and with a president and leadership that can push in that direction is moving from anger to action. And at this point, it's not entirely clear to me that they're going to be able to accomplish that, even if they're able to take the reins of power in Washington.
So I don't want to get down the filibuster rabbit hole too much, but I just want to just note, sure, though, that every time we discuss the Senate Majority Leader's actions in the Senate, I always get email or tweets from people who say, well, the man who pushed the snowball down the mountain was actually Harry Reid when he used the nuclear option on those federal level court appointments to break the filibuster. And so I just the tribalism rings true because people can look to different parts of the Senate's recent history and find their villain of choice when it comes to norm busting. But that gets me to a deeper question. You want to respond to that? Go ahead.
I would like to respond, sure, to that, because I was very much immersed in this at the time that it happened. And, you know, fundamentally what happened is Mitch McConnell, there were three vacancies on the D.C. Circuit, which is the most significant court below the Supreme Court. It deals with all the questions of separation of powers, federal regulations. And it had a conservative majority. There were three vacancies that were going to change that majority that were there for Barack Obama to fill. And Mitch McConnell went to Harry Reid and said, "I don't care who gets nominated. Could be the most qualified and moderate person in the history of America. None of them are going to be confirmed by us. We are going to keep that court the way it is now." And Harry Reid had a very difficult choice. It was to go along with an unprecedented obstruction of a president with a rightful ability to fill vacancies or to change the rules, because this was an unprecedented abuse of the power of the Senate to block things, of a minority to block things. After a long time, he chose the latter course. If he had not done that, then that D.C. circuit would have hamstrung Barack Obama through the rest of his presidency. And at this point, we would have a super majority of conservatives on the D.C. circuit. What Harry Reid did was not a willful act. It was an act where he had a gun to his head and had very little choice. So it is very much a distortion to say it's all Harry Reid's fault because he unleashed this.
Okay. Well, Jack, I want to turn back to what Norm was saying about the Democratic Party, right? Because I'm keenly interested in hearing from both of you about how the nation itself moves forward. Because Norm's identifying what he sees as a potential weakness within the Democrats themselves in terms of being the party that leads America through its sort of civic convalescence, if that's to happen. What do you think?
Well, just a data point on anger among Democrats. A recent political science paper, I quote from it, found that majorities of Democrats and Republicans alike view the other party as, quote, serious threat to the United States and its people, end quote, while Democrats were slightly more likely to say that, quote, violence would be justified if the opposing party won the 2020 election. That's a measure of anger that is quite extraordinary. I think it's just important to get in just how angry Democrats are, if that's a fair representation of them. I think one problem, and I want to hear Norm on this, is that the Democrats think of themselves as the party of government, the responsible people. And I can imagine a Biden administration that would, you know, not go after its political, the malfeasance in the Trump administration, that would be prudent in government, that would, play by the rules, and that would be effectively stymied at every turn by what Norm calls the ruthless pragmatism of McConnell and his ilk, and that the Democrats would pay for that in losing the congressional midterm elections because they were trying to be responsible. I mean, I can see that responsibility is the temptation for the Democrats. It's what Democratic voters used to want. They want their party to compromise, but it can lead you into a Republican-defined sort of moral universe where they get the upper hand.
So I'll respond to that, Jack is right, but by saying something more broadly that we haven't gotten to yet, which is the political system designed by our framers, altered through constitutional amendments over a significant period of time, has become seriously distorted over the last few decades. When we created a system that had a Senate with two senators from every state and that gave a lot of power to the states and did so through the Electoral College as well, the ratio of population between the largest and smallest states was about 12 to 1. Now it's 70 to 1. Mm-hmm. By 2040, 50% of Americans will live in only 8 states. 70% will live in 15 states. And that means that we're going to have more and more elections where a majority of the population choose a presidential candidate who doesn't become the president. That's been true in 6 out of the last 7 elections. The president, the Republican Party lost the majority, but they have dominated the political process. And it's not just about the Republican Party at this point. It's about distortions in the system from the Electoral College to the Senate. Imagine a Senate in 2040 where 30% of Americans elect 70 senators and where voting rights are being hampered on a daily basis. One thing Democrats are going to have to do, and I don't think they can do it without changing some of their rules, is to pass a democracy package, a new Voting Rights Act, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, after this Supreme Court, stacked with Republicans, blew up the Voting Rights Act, campaign finance reform. I think we need to add some places, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands as states. We should probably enlarge the House, which hasn't been done since 1929, and which would, in fact, create a little bit less of an imbalance in the Electoral College. But that's not going to happen unless Democrats are united and understand that they're going to have to change their own rules and get a lot of flack for doing so. borrow some of the pages from the McConnell war plan, but not all. Into the abyss.
Okay, so you got us to a place, Norm, that I wanted to dwell in the last couple of minutes of this show, and that is, you even just in the titles of your books that you've written, that you have authored and co-authored over the past many years, we're basically, the nation is experiencing the culmination of a long period of work and effort by, if we focus on the Republicans, by power brokers in the Republican Party. And this is where we have arrived. Norms have been shattered. The very foundations upon which we're talking about the basic democratic institutions in this country, shaken. And at the same time, both you and Jack are talking about a Democratic Party that, due to its the anger of its base, its perhaps its own internal divisions, a question of whether or not it has the stomach or willingness to adopt the same kind of master plan or power brokering that you're talking about that Mitch McConnell has led. Questions around that. I guess what I'm trying to pull this all together and say, well, if that is the case and the goalposts have been permanently shifted here, how are we even going to begin to repair this democracy? It doesn't sound like you're telling me that you have a tremendous amount of faith in either party really to truly lead the way to that.
I think the short term is going to be a very difficult time for us. Substantively, we have enormous problems from the climate to healthcare to getting through this pandemic to a global economy. Even a fully functioning political system would have difficulty. The parties are not going to change dramatically. I do believe that to get a Republican Party back to where it needs to be, they have to lose in 2020 and again in 2022, three in a row to begin to get responsible conservatives back to having any traction. But it's going to take new leadership at the top, first of all, from a president. It's going to take determination on the part of people in Congress in the short run, but then slowly to begin to restore some of those norms of decency, civility, and governance. It's going to take a lot of work to change outside forces, including the media. Mm. And we have these continuing issues that are revolving around race and ethnicity that have been with us forever, that are getting to be more of a challenge in the country. Nobody should expect sweetness and light for a while. And by the way, nobody should think that the Democratic Party is filled with white knights or knights of any sort. There are no angels here. But it's going to take a Democratic Party to make some changes and yet keep it within some bounds to begin to restore a country that we need, which is people, fierce partisans battling over policy, but working together for the greater good and the common good. And it's going to take all of us to try and play a role in making that happen as well.
Norm Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, contributing writer for The Atlantic and also at the National Journal. Thank you so much for joining us today, Norm.
It's always a pleasure.
Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. Jack, thank you as well.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.